Good morning and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness and Interim Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute. During the first half of today's program, we'll be speaking with Greg LeRoy, the Executive Director of Good Jobs First. We'll be speaking with Greg about a major new development in the effort to bring accountability to the economic subsidy game by which state and local governments give tax breaks to businesses in return for promises, not always kept, to create or retain jobs. And later in today's program, at about 8:30, we'll be speaking with the Capital Region's representative in Congress, the Honorable Paul Tonko. But right now, it's our pleasure to be joined on the telephone by Greg LeRoy, the Executive Director of Good Jobs First. Greg, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Great to be with you, Frank. Good morning, Ron, and everybody.
Morning, and Brian.
John. Yeah, so Brian.
Good morning.
So it's three of us ganging up on you today.
He can handle it, Brian. Don't you worry.
This is Brian McDonnell. I'd also like to welcome our guest, Greg LeRoy of Good Jobs First, to The People's Business here on WRPI Troy. Greg, before we talk about the proposed change in economic development subsidy accountability, can you tell us a little bit about the world of state and local government subsidies for businesses? There seems to be an arms race between some states and some localities to land businesses, and they seem to be giving away the store to bring them in.
Well, it's really true. We have what's called the economic war among the states. That was actually a phrase coined decades ago by Businessweek magazine. It's estimated that states and cities spend about $70 billion a year in the name of economic development, although because we don't have the rule that we're going to talk about this morning yet in place, it's only an estimate. It's only an educated guess. And not only do we have a war among states, like New Jersey pirating jobs from Manhattan or Connecticut pirating jobs from Manhattan, which is a long-standing story in the tri-state area there, but also then a war among suburbs within the same metropolitan area, which is a big problem in places like your Buffalo metropolitan area and your Rochester metropolitan area in upstate New York.
Yeah, we seem to be poaching jobs from each other everywhere we go, whether it's state to state or county to county. It doesn't seem to matter. But this is Ron Deutsch. I also want to welcome you, Greg LeRoy, of Good Jobs First, to The People's Business here on WRPI in Troy. You know, there's been a lot of discussion in New York. We seem to be the poster child for a lot of the mega deals that go on in terms of economic development subsidy programs. But we really don't know if we're getting a good bang for our buck. And as you mentioned, you know, for whether it's from state to state or county to county, we keep shifting the deck chairs on the Titanic, if you will, in the hopes that things will improve. But, you know, I like to say when I talk about economic development, you know, it seems like it's the very definition of insanity. We keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. But it seems like there are some good things happening on the national scene right now in the name of best practices. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Well, if you want to talk specifically about the GASB rule or about anti-piracy as well.
What we'd like to know is what are some state and local governments already doing, and what are you and your colleagues at Good Jobs First urging state and local governments to do in the name of best practices?
Sure.
What are best practices?
So, I mean, specifically in this problem of piracy, there's two studies that we've issued recently and one development in the Midwest that have lots of good insight for your situation there in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. Last summer, after a group of businesses in Kansas City, straddling the Kansas-Missouri border there, the state of Missouri enacted a law led by the Republican legislature and the Democratic governor saying that they want to quit wasting money pirating jobs back and forth across the state line in the Kansas City metropolitan area. The two states there have wasted about $300 billion in the last 5 or 6 years simply moving people, you know, changing people's commuting patterns, but not really creating any new jobs in the metro area. The law in Missouri says if within 2 years Kansas reciprocates, Missouri will stop paying companies to jump the state line in that Kansas City metropolitan area. And now it's basically the ball is in Governor Brownback's court now that he got reelected. This is the first time ever. You know, there's been handshake agreements. There's been PR stunts in the past with, you know, cooperation agreements among governors in New England and the Midwest and places like that. This is the first time ever a state has enacted a legally binding, you know, really with teeth law saying we will create half of a bilateral ceasefire agreement. If that happens, if Kansas reciprocates, we're certainly going to get loud about Albany and Trenton and Hartford taking notice and thinking about doing the same thing in the tri-state area there. We also published another study looking at how this can play out within a state in a big metropolitan area. We profiled Denver, Colorado, and Dayton, Ohio metropolitan areas, where for more than 20 years there have been these very sophisticated no-piracy agreements in place being run by these sort of umbrella regional economic development agencies of those two metro areas. And it basically says this: nobody's going to tell a company where to locate or where not to locate, but if a company signals that it wants to move around, if it currently resides in City A and it goes and knocks on the door of City B and says, you know, with its handout saying, what have you got for me if I run away from City A and come jump into your lap here in City B, City B is required under these agreements to call City A when that meeting is over and rat the company out basically and say, you know, we're not going to tell you can't move, but we're not going to actively pirate, and we are going to cooperate, and we're going to favor trying to keep you where you are if that's possible. Those systems have been in place for more than 20 years in each metropolitan area. They've been very successful. Those areas don't waste money pirating jobs from each other, unlike Rochester, unlike Buffalo. And we think it's a really great model for other cities all across the country.
One of the other reforms that our guest Greg LeRoy and his organization Good Jobs First have been promoting for years is something called clawbacks. How do clawbacks work, and does it actually work well anyplace?
And Frank and I know this story all too well because we tried to get the first Governor Cuomo to sign a clawback bill on the eve of his last election.
Maybe we'll get the second Governor Cuomo to do it.
So a clawback is very intuitive. It's basically the subtitle that we call them money-back guarantees. That is, if we're going to give a company, you know, $50 million and say it's going to create 500 jobs, if it only creates 250 jobs, well, let's get half our money back. And so it's a contractual, you know, black and white obligation in which both sides are clear about what's going to happen if the company falls short on its side of the deal. You know, we wouldn't pay a company $50 million to pave 100 miles of highway and let them pay 50 miles of highway and keep all the money. Why would we do the same, anything different, just because the program is called economic development instead of highway procurement?
Right, or highway robbery. We're yeah. speaking to Greg LeRoy, who's the executive director and founder of Good Jobs First. The website, if you want to look at the amazing collection of work that Greg and his colleagues have done, is goodjobsfirst.org. Greg, so now we have a picture of the huge amount of money, an estimated $70 billion a year, being devoted to the subsidy games, and the fact that many of these economic development deals are wishful thinking. And we now have an understanding of the efforts by your organization and some other reform-minded activists and academics and a smattering of reform-minded government officials around the country trying to add some accountability and transparency to this picture by getting an increasing number of state and local governments on a one-at-a-time basis to implement disclosure requirements and clawback laws and other reforms. Mm-hmm. And now along comes some private, nonprofit accounting organization with more leverage than many government agencies, with the potential to make every state and local government in the United States implement a version of the disclosure requirements that you and others have been advancing on a piecemeal, one government at a time basis for a decade. So tell us about the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. What is it? What is the scope of its power? And what is it proposing to do that would represent a big step forward in subsidy accountability?
Oh, thanks for asking, Frank. And this is really the big, big news in our world right now. So this group you mentioned is called the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, or GASB, as we call it, which despite its name is not government. It's a project of a nonprofit group called the Financial Accounting Foundation. GASB sets forth what's called the Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, which most state and local governments all across the United States must adhere to. Sometimes they are obligated by law to adhere to so-called GAAP, again, Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, or effectively because Wall Street bond analysts who rate bonds that are sold by governments on Wall Street insist that they adhere to GAAP as well. So it has this enormous informal power despite itself not being a government regulator or a government body. Well, we have been critical of GASB for many years because GASB has never set forth any kind of rules for the way state or local governments have to account for this estimated $70 billion a year. As you mentioned, Frank, we've been sort of doing it one place at a time. We've been issuing report card studies. We've been shaming the states. We've been cajoling the states. We've been gathering the data that does get disclosed into a big searchable database on our website called Subsidy Tracker, but it's voluntary, you know, and there's some states that don't disclose at all, and there's some states that disclose very poorly, and there's gobs of cities and counties and school districts and so on that don't disclose at all, not even gross cost data, much less company-specific data, which is what we always like as well. So out of the blue, in late September, we learned that GASB had for 2.5 years been chewing on this idea and was about to issue a so-called exposure draft, a proposed set of rules that would guide state and local governments, requiring them to at least report for 1 year for each program the total amount of money, revenue, tax revenue, lost because of the existence of that program. So every property tax abatement program, every income tax, corporate income tax credit program, every, you know, whatever the nature of the program is, would have to be disclosed. And a couple of other important improvements would come along with that. If you were a government body that lost revenue passively as the result of the actions of a different body of government, you would have to report that as well. And that's a huge rule because it would specifically mostly apply to school districts, which in most states do not have a seat at the table and do not make decisions about tax breaks, but are often the biggest losers. When a company gets a big property tax break, for instance, it's usually schools that are the biggest dollar loser because schools are the most costly local public service. But now school districts will have to at least own up to how much revenue they're not getting as a result of these programs. So that's the short version of it. We're now encouraging people to file comments. There's already been a fabulous comment filed by groups represented by both of your other co-hosts this morning, AFSCME and New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness and the Fiscal Policy Institute, all three of your groups represented there, as well as 10 other organizations in New York State, pointing out particular technical issues in the quality of the data that we're concerned about to make sure to get GASB to improve the rule so that all the spending in New York State and every other state would become transparent. We're very optimistic about this, but we're certainly encouraging people to file comments. There's still another month and a half left. We have until January 30 to file comments with GASB. And you can see all that at our website, goodjobsfirst.org, or just go straight to GASB, GASB.org. It's quite easy to find it there, too.
Yeah. This is certainly something that all three of us around this table have been concerned about for a long time. I know New York is kind of the poster child for a lot of these mega deals that have been going on across the country. But I think also, you know, we look at the kind of proliferation of the tax credits in New York that have really been ballooning over the last 7 or 8 years. I know in 2005, we were spending like $600 million. Now we're up to somewhere around $1.7, $1.8 billion a year on a variety of different tax credits and subsidies for things like brownfield redevelopment and incentives to Hollywood production companies to film in New York. But there are also a lot of other smaller tax credits as well. And some reviews of them in New York have basically shown that they're ineffective. They're not producing the jobs that people thought that they would produce. So I'm wondering, are these type of tax credits included under the GASB rule in terms of looking at these and increasing the reporting requirements?
Well, we hope so. That's really where the battle lies right now, and that's certainly where the comment that your three organizations and your 10 allies filed, we hope will make a difference. So, for instance, there's an ambiguity in the way the wording currently exists with the GASB draft exposure draft, which says it's unclear, for instance, if something called performance-based incentives would qualify. So this would include two of your costliest programs there in New York State, your brownfield tax credit program and your film production tax credit, which together are about $1 billion a year in the state. Those two programs, because they're structured in a way where the company doesn't get the tax break until later on when it does what it says it's supposed to do under the deal, so to speak, It's unclear. We're worried that the way the GASB structure is worded right now, that those would not get included. So we're encouraging people with costly programs that are so-called performance-based to point this out to GASB and make sure it gets covered. Another big problem we have in many states, not so much in your state, is something called tax increment financing, or TIF, in which companies technically pay higher taxes rather than getting a tax break and therefore might elude the GASB definition. But the way that money gets spent often is a rebate or paid right back to the company or spent in ways that directly benefits the company and is in some states extremely costly, we think belongs inside the definition too.
Greg, many of us know about GASB because they're the organization that's been calling for governments to cost out liabilities for pensions and for future health care costs. Right. Now, this seems to be a different direction for the organization. Why do you think they're heading in this direction?
You know, we can't be sure why. They're pretty secretive about why they take up any given issue at any given time. But you're right. I mean,
we should just be thankful, right?
Yes, maybe there's a little bit of justice now that they're going to capture so-called corporate welfare on the other side of the ledger. But for instance, that is a justice issue, frankly, too. As currently worded, the standard says you would just report 1 year of revenue losses. You would not report past years, and you would not reveal what you know about future obligations that you've already made. Unlike pension obligations or retiree health care obligations, which do have to be costed out in future years. And so other commenters have already begun to point out that that's inconsistent, and that if you're going to require one form of future expenditure to be reported, why not corporate tax breaks as well? And we completely agree, and we certainly know that in many cases. I mean, Washington State enacted an $8.7 billion deal for Boeing and its suppliers last winter. They know it's 8.7. It's in the law. That's the way it's written. Nevada just did a $1.3 billion deal for Tesla. We know that's the price tag because it's in the legislation. Why wouldn't you be required to report that? Because those things are going to be squeezing those states' budgets for years and years to come, and taxpayers should be able to see those monies, see those budget icebergs out ahead.
Right. That's what you mentioned for Boeing in Washington State is similar to what New York did for the company that is now called Global Foundries.
Yes.
A large chip fabrication plant with a multi-year tax deal that was enacted back in, I think, George Pataki's last year. I think Senator Joseph Bruno, former majority leader who used to represent the area where we are today at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, was the godfather of that program and got it through before Pataki left office.
That's right. And in fact, Ron's mentioned a few times these so-called mega deals. That's a term we coined last year when we published a study looking at really big deals, typically nine-figure or ten-figure deals. And New York State, despite being this reputation of a state with a dead economy and, you know, hurting economy, has actually had more dollars spent on these huge mega deals than any other state in the country. We tabbed it already at that point at $11.3 billion wrapped up in just 23 individual company deals. So almost $500 million per deal on average. And the second biggest one of those was the deal that Frank just mentioned, the Global Foundries fabricated chip plant. The biggest one was for the cheap electricity deal in upstate New York that the Buffalo News revealed to Alcoa, which was worth $5.6 billion.
These numbers are just staggering. You know, I was looking at that example about the Tesla Motors going to Nevada. It's the county that is trying to entice them in is called Story County. Very small population, but the amount of money we're talking about is, I mean, it's mind-boggling. It seems to me that they're giving away the store for hopes of the future when, you know, a company like this seems to be shopping around for the next potential buyer.
Yeah, I think Story County is going to have a big squeeze, too, because that you're right, it's a small population county. If the deal succeeds, and there really are 6,000 new jobs created, that's going to create a huge amount of growth. A lot of people are going to move there. You're going to have to hire a lot of teachers, build a lot of classrooms, widen a lot of lanes, pick up a lot of trash. None of those things are free, but Tesla is not going to pay a dime for it. And guess who's going to pay for it? Everybody else.
Not a heartening thought. We're speaking to Greg LeRoy, the executive director of Good Jobs First, goodjobsfirst.org. Greg, for people who might be listening, there are a wide range of organizations that should think about looking into this. For example, PTAs have a stake in this reform.
They absolutely do. Anybody who cares about adequate and fair funding for schools should be considering filing a comment with GASB, and here's why. I mentioned before that if you're a body of government which loses money passively as the result of the actions of a different body of government, you, under the GASB rule, you would have to report that revenue loss. And that especially applies to school districts, school boards, who lose money because of property tax deals or income tax deals or sales tax deals cut by typically by cities or counties or townships or other local bodies of government. We did a big study for NEA years ago showing that in almost every state, the school districts are really viewed as kind of stepchildren in this process. They are the biggest losers, and they have the least say in the process. So we think it will be a huge positive for every PTAs and anybody else who cares about adequate funding for schools to get this data, which will start flowing in 2017, and realize how much money is being lost and could be reined in if these programs were administered better.
An example of the situation that our guest Greg LeRoy just described, where school districts have to swallow part of the cost even though they aren't a decision maker, is the way IDA tax abatements work currently. That we have a law that a school district can ask to be heard before a meeting of the IDA, but they have no actual vote or influence, but they can jawbone.
And that's very typical.
Right.
Kind of a token role.
I think we've long urged these local IDAs to be more inclusive on who's on their boards and have affected parties be on their board. So, you know, why not have school superintendents or school board members who are going to be the ones affected by foregoing tax revenue to the school based on some of these deals to have a seat at the table when they're making these decisions. So, I mean, it seems like that's a no-brainer to me.
Well, so last year, to remedy this issue, there was a bill introduced that CSEA, the Public Employee Union, pushed to get in that would make three participants, the county IDA, the towns affected, and the school districts all have to sign off in agreement before any grant like that was given. So we are trying to, on a piecemeal level, deal with this issue as well. But
yeah, we're trying, Greg.
We're trying.
Great. Well, and that's exactly the right thing to be done, I think. And then the question is, would the school board, you know, get buffaloed every time and muscled into going along, or would it actually exercise its veto power?
Right.
And hopefully having this new data available, thanks to the GASB rule, in a couple of years, school boards would be more likely to do the right thing in that if they had that power.
We're speaking to Greg LeRoy, Executive Director of Good Jobs First. Greg, before we finish up, let's mention one more time how listeners can learn more about the issue we've been talking about and the GASB proposal, and what information is available on your organization's website, goodjobsfirst.org, for those people who are interested.
Sure. So again, our website, as you mentioned, is goodjobsfirst, all one word, and first is spelled out, .org. If you go to that website and then just add /GASB, G-A-S-B, you'll get a page with all kinds of information about it. A primer on GASB and the rule itself, links to the original GASB document, links to a fuller analysis that we have published about the rules, links to the comments that have been filed by the 13 New York State groups and other excellent groups from groups around the country that we've been collecting and posting, and links directly to GASB's website itself where you can read the original document. It's all there. It's all user-friendly, and we encourage people to use that and reach out to us. And if you want information about filing, or you want information about who else in your community might be interested in filing, chances are we know them, and we'd be glad to hit you up.
Greg, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks, Ron. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye.
Before we hear from our next guest, U.S. Congressman Paul Tonko, I thought we could talk a little bit about a conference that the Fiscal Policy Institute co-hosted last week with Cornell University on local fiscal stress, state austerity policy, and creative local response. Now, I was there, and I had the pleasure of serving on one of the panels. But, Ron, why don't you tell us a little bit about the conference and the issues that were discussed?
Sure. We had a great conference. It's kind of a launching of a partnership with Cornell University and their Community and Regional Development Institute in particular. What we wanted to do is really come together, bring together school district officials, municipal officials, local elected officials, along with unions and community groups and others, to really kind of take a look at the impact of not only the state's austerity policies, but also the tax cap that was put in place a number of years ago, in particular the property tax cap I'm referring to, and also the property tax freeze credit, which many people may have gotten there anywhere from $9 to $59 checks in the mail.
We got 85.
Oh, yes, all right. That's right. Well, you must be one of the lucky few. but yeah, I mean, it is really a big discrepancy across the board. But leaving that aside, we can have a whole show on tax freeze checks. But really what we were doing is trying to figure out, you know, there's been some creative local response where there's been some shared services. But the reality is that local governments and school districts are really being squeezed right now. And we want to acknowledge that fact, that the tax cap in particular and the austerity measures in terms of state spending that have been put in place are squeezing local governments, squeezing school districts to the point where they can't continue to deliver quality services to the people in their communities. So how do we address that? How do we reverse that? I think coming out of that conference, there was some agreement among many of the participants in that we needed to work more closely together to address these issues. We need to work together to address some of the shortcomings of the property tax cap that was put in place and figure out ways that we can help rebuild our communities. So I think it was an interesting conference, and I know I had a good time and appreciate everybody's participation in it.
I think it was very timely because, the governor's been talking about forced consolidation. Sure. And one of the things that came out of the conference that Cornell has done a lot of research on the fact that the forced consolidation is not really going to save anybody any money. And in fact, as you mentioned, will hamper local governments from delivering services. I really believe going into 2015 that it's going to be the year of local government. The governor has been pointing his finger at local government and saying that they don't have their fiscal houses in order.
Right.
So I think that very appropriate to have this conference at the time that we did.
Besides people like us and faculty members from Cornell, an impressive part of the program was that teams of graduate students from Cornell prepared reports on each of the topics that the conference had panels on. If you want to see all the reports and handouts from the conference, just Google Cornell and CARDI, and you'll get the CARDI page on the Cornell website where they have posted all the student papers, all the faculty papers, and links to videos.
Yeah, we live stream the entire event.
So. And it's a archived, available through links on the CARDI website.
So we hope that you go to that website and enjoy that material. But if anybody has any questions, you can certainly contact the Fiscal Policy Institute. Or if you want more information, please give us a call or reach out to the Fiscal Policy Institute.
What struck me about the conference is that a lot of us have been sort of heading down these parallel roads. So we, and you know, certainly NYSET, representing teachers, have been talking about these issues for years. We were not aware, I think, that Cornell was doing so much research on this topic, and they were saying many of the same things that we've been saying. So it's nice to see that we've got such a credible partner, and Frank is right that, you know, the students' research was very impressive. I think there's a lot to be discussed in this issue.
After a brief break, we'll be back to speak with the Capital Region's representative in Congress, the Honorable Paul Tonko.
The chances of mercury poisoning increase. Mercury poisoning may cause neurological damage that impairs learning, vision, and memory. And mercury itself has become part of our everyday lives, absorbed by certain fish, taken into our bodies, and passed on to our children like a common cold. But you can stop this. Log on to earthshare.org and find out how. A public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Drugs destroyed holidays for my family.
I don't think I ever truly realized how serious it was.
I never thought it would happen to me. I never thought it would be my child.
They're always afraid if they give you a gift, Are you gonna go off and pawn it for crack?
I was so high that I literally passed out in my food at the table.
It was the worst Christmas Eve and Christmas Day that I've ever spent.
And the only thing that's on your mind, the single thing that you care about, is getting high.
It's like getting caught in a tornado. It just sucks you up.
This is WRPI Troy at 91.5.
And I remember my mother saying to me one day, "You're going to die if you don't get help." I wanted to have my life back and my family back. And that's when my mother found Narcanon.
If you or someone you love has a drug or alcohol problem, call Narcanon today at 1-800-468-6933 or visit us at www.stopaddiction.com.
This is WRPI Troy at 91.5 FM and live on the internet at www.wrpi.org.
Good morning and welcome back to The People's Business on WRPI Troy, a project of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee. The Public Affairs Committee at WRPI is here every Tuesday. We're here only once in a while, but they do Capital District Progressive Radio every Tuesday morning. This is the beginning of the holiday season. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Mm-hmm. We'll be back in January. But one group of people who are waiting for a Christmas present, and we don't know if they're going to get it, and we're going to talk about this later in the show, is state legislators haven't had a pay raise since January 1999. So we don't know if the Christmas season will be good for them finally this year, and we'll talk about that later in the program. But first, we have the honor of being joined by the congressman for this area, Paul Tonko. Paul, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Hey, my pleasure. It's always an honor to speak with you, gentlemen.
Congressman, this is Brian McDonald. Welcome to The People's Business. We're happy to
Thank
have you,
Brian.
On. There's been a lot going on in your neck of the woods. I there's so much we could talk about, but I assume you want to talk about Cromnibus and what the Congress just went through, passing the massive spending plan and all the pork that was involved and the side deals. Just a fascinating situation.
Yeah, it was quite the week last week as we put together a $1.1 trillion spending bill. And, at first it seemed as though it would be an acceptable package. We undid some of the cuts to very important programs to the middle-income community and to the poor. We were able to introduce some good measures into the bill that spoke to the needs of the 20th Congressional District. But then in a 11th-hour surge, if not beyond, they decided that it would be a good thing to put in a big gift for the banking and investment community, the big banks, giving them some taxpayer dollars to absorb the risk of these derivative actions. And, pretty much the statement was, if we profit, the money goes into our pocket. If we don't, the risk goes into your hands, which was, I think, a repeat of behavior that caused the Great Recession and brought this American economy to its knees. So that measure, along with the effort to provide for campaign monies for the most powerful, the super rich donor could give much more now per election cycle to political parties and their campaign committees. And the limits to date were like at $195,000 or so. They were raising them to some $1.6 million. So the egregious nature of pouring more wealthy donations into the political process and giving the sweetheart deals to the banks, the big banks, was reason enough, I believe, for a no vote on that $1.1 trillion plan.
Well, it is the holiday season, Congressman, so giving away typical, right?
I don't know, Ron. I think that, they took what was an acceptable bill and made it objectionable simply by introducing those measures. And, a number of those items run for 9 months. They're, up to the deadline, the September 30th, October 1st federal budget deadline. And, undid some of the cuts, but they're there as a temporary measure. These items were brought in as, you know, a law of the land. So this long-term permanent outcome for, you know, undoing some of the improvements of Dodd-Frank just allowed for, again, a response for the taxpayer. We're committing taxpayer dollars to, you know, deal with the unknown, the investment strategy of derivatives, and you know, we're putting the risk of that back into the taxpayers and asking them to be the bailout mechanism.
Right. It doesn't seem like we learned from history, but this is Ron Deutsch.
Recent history, I might add. Recent history.
I just want to welcome you to the program officially here on WRPI in Troy.
It's always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to have you on, Congressman. But before we talk more about some of the omnibus spending bill and whatnot, I want to know, get a sense from you, Congressman, what's your outlook for the new Congress? So, you know, given the fact that the Republicans are in the majority in both houses in Congress for the first time since President Obama took office, you know, have you lowered your expectations on what could or couldn't get done in terms of meaningful public policy? Or what's your take on how things are going to move forward?
Well, you know, I think there's a bit of a signal coming from this plan, this $1.1 trillion plan. You know, we provided funding, as I said, through September 30th, which is the end of the current federal budget year. There was an exception made. And that was to the Department of Homeland Security, which is funded only to the end of February. And that, of course, is about the impact of the immigration policy. And I can see already that there will probably be some very contentious efforts over that, and probably the Affordable Care Act, and probably a number of measures that will speak to the environment, the EPA, and various investments that I think are required for an innovation economy to work. And so that could be setting the tone. Now, it looks as though the elected group, the new group that has come in, may be to the right of the given members in mass, so that we may see even more behavior as that which we just described with the $1.1 trillion plan, moving even further right than we saw last week.
Congressman, if we could get back to Cromnibus for a second. And for our listeners who don't know, it's called Cromnibus because it's an omnibus spending plan, and it combines a continuing resolution, which is how the government has been operating the last several years. What struck me was just sort of the audacity of the Wall Street the banksters, you know, the Jamie Dimons of the world, this entitlement mentality that less than 5 years after the great crash that they basically caused to our economy, now they're going back and saying, as you just mentioned, that we should privatize the profit and socialize the cost or the potential cost.
Absolutely. Not only is it a risky situation where we're back into that whole effort of reducing the impact of Dodd-Frank, you know, I watched as we came back from that recession. I got to town in January of 2009, and we dipped our lowest in March of 2009. We were losing 800,000 to 900,000 jobs per month. That is still a painful reminder of how really difficult that moment was. And people had trusted in the investment community, they lost everything for which they ever worked. And, you know, if we're willing to just be cavalier and say we can play that risky game again, shame on the process. And, you know, what it's done here, I think, is really, really shown who is more important. We had a chance to make a statement here that, you know, we're for the middle-income community. We're for the poor. We're for growing the economy with the opportunity, the dignity of work being the outcome for the great many of us. And instead, it's like dealing and yielding to the big banks and the investment community and to the donors who are highest on that income strata, perched high up on the top, saying, yeah, you know, will give you more opportunity to influence elections. You know, we just came off a very telling election year. I think that there was anger with both parties, and rightfully so. People want to see progress. They want to see work done. Here we get very little done, but the big stuff that gets done speaks to against the grain of what I think the message was in this election. We want campaign finance reform. We want to get special deep pocket money interests out of the process. We want to weaken that impact, and we want to make certain that we grow the economy. And here we just took care of special interests and gave the wealth of this country a greater shot at influencing these elections, which will continue to take these new voices placed in the congressional arena and allow for more special interest policy coming out of the process.
We're speaking with Congressman Paul Tonko. You can visit his House of Representatives website at a very easy-to-remember address, tonko.house.gov. In terms of this provision that gives some more support to the banks and undoes some of Dodd-Frank, how does something like that get into an appropriations bill, and how did you and your colleagues learn about it?
Well, again, it was post-11th hour. I believe, the strongest message out there, or one of the most recurring responses has been that some of the banking groups actually wrote the measure. There were many who were citing Citibank, and they were suggesting that they needed this in order to have a competitive quality within that financial industry arena, and convince some people to introduce that measure. Now, I know from the appropriators, we had been constantly updated by our appropriations committee, and the word was that this all came up in the very last minute, and people were unsure as to how it happened. And, it's that kind of strategy that tells us that it's a risky situation. Otherwise, had it been, had there been a secure, confident feeling about this add-on, people would have made it public and clear and acknowledged it to the legislative bodies earlier on. But I think they knew it had, it was a shaky sort of amendment to the plan that we had, and it was introduced, way at the tail end of the process. And it's unfortunate because we worked so very hard to get some good measures into bill. I had worked with the appropriators to make certain that we had this Alzheimer's program that was introduced that is now made certain. It's made permanent. The Alzheimer's Accountability Act, which was a standalone measure. I was the lead Democrat on that bill. We worked to get that measure into the final plan, as we did with investments in CAPL, the NOES Atomic Power Lab, which is important to not only our local economy, our regional economy, but to the preparedness of this country for her defense purposes and for private sector job growth. And we had also worked on the submarine training for the Naval Reactor program at Kesselring, making certain that the upgrades were there and that we did put together a plan that enabled us to continually put out the specifically trained naval fleet that is required to, again, speak to our defense situations. So all of these efforts of the good were tarnished by this effort to take good care of the big banks that, introduced the legislative add-on that really was a sweetheart deal.
Congressman Tonko, in relation to the part of the positive part of the process you were describing, where you work to ensure inclusion of an accountability provision on Alzheimer and funding for the Knowles Atomic Power Laboratory, how does that actually work? What do you have to do to get measures like that into an omnibus appropriations bill like this?
Well, we worked with both houses, and we worked with both sides of leadership, the Dems and the Republicans in the House. And, you know, Representative Guthrie and I were the lead sponsors on the Alzheimer's bill, for instance. And we made certain that we carried it to both sets of leaders and made, you know, every effort working with the Alzheimer's advocacy community to make certain that these improvements were part of the process.
So is Guthrie a Republican?
Yes. And, you know, and we they had discussion. They had all sorts of meetings that, where they would be updating the individual houses, and we were pleased with some of the efforts that were made. I mean, it was far from perfect as a plan, but at least it deserved, I think, a yay vote because of the improvements that were there, that we were moving in the right direction. You know, there were other efforts that certainly were somewhat concerning. You know, we saw some of the school lunch issues impacted, some cuts to EPA that impact that agency. You know, I don't think the desire for this country to have cleaner air to breathe or cleaner water to drink has diminished any, but EPA is a favorite agency to deny these days. And, you know, some of those things are very troubling, but at least there was a balance there with good, and good that could be tremendously, you know, measured in this 20th congressional district. We know the economic impact, you know, which is tremendous for this local economy with the investments that are made at Capel, the investments that are made at Kesselrink, the investments that are made at Glenville where they had environmental cleanup. These were important measures that, you know, the community was thrilled about, I think. They saw it as some work getting done in Washington at a time where status quo just doesn't cut it. But then to put on this baggage, so to speak, with the in the tail end of the process, you know, you look at some of the campaign money issues that they addressed in the direct opposite direction of what I think the public is calling for. This really makes you wonder if they're listening to what the voters are saying in their given respective districts.
In the end, in the House of Representatives, both the Republicans and the Democrats were divided. A majority of both groups, a majority of Republicans and a majority of Democrats, voted for the bill, and a minority of each of the two parties voted against it. Do you think this signals a way the House is likely to operate in the coming year?
Well, you know, I think people saw this as a last shot to be able to get some good things done in the budget and move forward, and so they were willing to look past these egregious measures, especially these two add-ons. My thinking was that, you know, they can come back in the new session, the 114th session of Congress, and they can undo that progress because they'll have the majority votes to do it. And so that short term, that 9-month long progress, the undoing of some cuts and the investments in certain areas could just be turned around. But what they got into that deal of last week was these sweetheart giveaways to the banking community, to the wealthiest in our society for campaign contribution purposes. Those are laws of the land now. And so I just didn't understand supporting that kind of effort, because that's what the give was here that enabled everybody to get the votes that they needed in both houses. I'll remind you too, when the rule came up for a vote, it was voted down, and it took Speaker Boehner walking on that House floor looking for two more votes to turn that around, two or three more votes.
On the Rules Committee or on the floor?
No, on the floor, on the vote on the rule. And so had that failed, they were going to have to go back and redo the package. And they worked these people. In fact, one who's not coming back, who lost the primary, caved to the pressure of the Speaker. And so you saw this very narrow victory, I think, for a progressive outcome, short-lived and turned around by some tremendous arm twisting on the right on the House floor. And so, you know, I think when you look at all of this, it just tells you that it's going to be a pretty difficult 114th session of Congress. And it takes, again, more public information feed. People are going to need to know with even more intensity what is happening or not happening in Washington, because these special interests are going to have a heyday if they're allowed to run free and easy.
Right. It does seem like the folks, particularly on the far right, are very upset that the new House majority has, agreed to a bill that did have a number of what they would view as giveaways to the left as well, right? So,
it is interesting. You found that a number of progressives in our caucus, and I would put myself in that crowd, were in agreement, vote-wise, with the far-right extreme in the Republican caucus conference. And we were on
so
the
you're
same
going
page.
To miss Michelle Bachmann?
Well, no. Yeah. I guess for once we were agreeing on a vote. But we were on the same page, but got there in for different purposes, and with different reasoning. And they were upset because they think there's too much spending in this bill. I'm upset because the law of the land now is that the rich and the most wealthy and powerful in our society will now be able to put in far more dollars, millions, over a million more per election cycle to either political party. I think that's wrong. It's egregious. It's not where I think our founding parents would have wanted us in a representative democracy. And again, it gives the banks this permanent reduction, if you will, of the nature of the law as it relates to derivatives. It's just opening up the potential, the risk for the taxpayer again. To say, hey, if we have profits, they go in our pocket. If we have risk, if we lost, the taxpayer bails us out. What didn't we hear? What didn't we learn from history, as you indicated, and for that matter, most recent history. I mean, people are still recovering from that economic woe. And we saw, how close we came to a full-blown depression. And that recession was turned around by this president. One of his greatest accomplishments in leading Congress from that low point of March 2009 and having private sector job growth steadily occur with all the ensuing months to the very last measurement for November of 2014. So, we were just willing to go out there and risk it all. And, it was a moment, I think, that the Democrats should have been united. We shouldn't have seen so many people voting for this measure. We had a split within the House. We had Senate Democrats, not heeding the advice of Senator Warren, who I think was spot on with this issue. And you had the White House that was trying to avoid a shutdown and said, well, this is the best we can do. And I think, if we had challenged them, we could have pulled out these last-minute add-on bonanzas for the most comfortable in society and got our work done and got it done correctly.
The theme of government for sale is what I was struck with, Congressman. So, and as you mentioned, 32 Senate Democrats voted in favor of this. The message that I heard from people after the 2014 elections was it's just too much money in politics, that it's just a wash in money. And, of course, now we're going to see even more of that. It's disheartening.
Yeah, it is. It's very disheartening. And we need campaign finance reform. When you look at how much money was spent in these given races, even locally for state legislative seats, and certainly for the gubernatorial elections across the country, I mean, it is, I think, the ruination of politics. And this should be about government of the many, not government of the money. And it's turning into a situation where if you have the fistful of dollars, you're getting your way. When these people are funding these campaigns with that high-income community, buying them seats in the House, the story doesn't end there. There's an IOU, and there's the demand, the list of bills and legislation and policy adjustment that is demanded. And you don't think that's going to speak favorably to the working families of this country and to the poor.
Right.
You don't even hear mention made of the poor, and you try to get mention made of the middle-income community on the House floor. And, when we have special orders, I will take advantage of those given hours assigned to either party and work with folks like John Garamendi or Marcy Kaptur or Louise Slaughter and go to the floor and say, hey, look, this is how we grow our economy. This is the sort of progressivity we need in the tax structure of this country. You know, we'll see. Are we going to sit down and have a tax reform discussion now? Are we going to have a solid discussion on how to make that more fair for the middle-income community? They can't be the payment mechanism for the cost of government.
Right. Well, we shall see.
We're saturating the taxpayer.
We shall see, and we'll have our guest Paul Tonko back to bring us up to date. It will be interesting. Congressman Tonko, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Congressman.
It's always a pleasure to join with all of you, and to your listeners and to you, gentlemen, the best of holiday seasons and a healthy and happy new year.
To you as well.
Merry Christmas to you also.
Merry Christmas, gentlemen.
If you would like to learn more about what Congressman Tonko is working on, visit his House of Representatives website, which has the easy-to-remember URL, tonko.house.gov. Ron Deutsch, a few months ago, you joined with the leaders of several good government groups in sending a letter to State Controller Tom DiNapoli, asking his office to take a closer look at several big tax subsidy projects. What's happening with this initiative?
Well, so far, what's happening is, as you mentioned, we sent the letter to the Office of the State Comptroller, we sent it to the New York City Comptroller, and we sent it to the Independent Budget Office in New York City. We've been following up with some meetings and moving forward, and I think they're very amenable to many of the changes that we want to make right now. So it's exciting, and we're going to keep moving that forward. But right now, you know, we have a lot going on here in Albany as well, which I think we wanted to talk about for a few minutes. And one of the things I really wanted to touch on was whether or not there will be a special session in Albany. And you brought this up at the beginning, Frank, about, you know, whether or not the legislature will get a pay raise. Will there be a special session? So I'm just wondering. I don't know. I think
we'll ask our political expert, Brian McDonald.
Yeah, Brian McDonald. What do you think?
I know we don't have much time. I think the clock is ticking not only on our show but on the session. As you know, you need to a legislature would need to vote it for the next legislature coming in 2015. There are 15 days left in the year. The governor was trying to wrangle some ethics reforms out of the legislature, although this governor, given with what's going on with the Moreland Commission, not so sure that he's the right messenger to be asking for that.
You don't think so?
If my money were on it, I think we run out of time and there's no legislative pay raise in 2014.
Okay, 15 days. 15. This is Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, fiscalpolicy.org, with Brian McDonald, the Legislative and Political Director of ASPE New York, and Ron Deutsch, the Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness and the Interim Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute. We thank you for joining us here on WRPI Troy for the People's Business, a part of Capital District Progressive Radio, as we try to cast a little sunshine on the ways in which government is doing and not doing the people's business. Now stay tuned for Democracy Now!